We are returning again this evening to the first cycle, as I talked about it last Lord's Day, the first cycle in the book of Micah, which we find in Micah chapters 1 and 2. Last week, we looked at the same passage, but our focus then was on the question of the word of God versus the wind of false teachers who tell us what we want to hear, pushing us to the question of who it was that we would ultimately listen to. This evening, we'll dig a bit deeper into the content of Micah's accusations against God's people that we find here. But as we do that, we'll come against something of a roadblock. Micah will speak in these chapters, and also, especially in the chapters that follow, about justice. But upon reflection, we would soon realize that we don't have, as a culture, a shared view of what justice really is. And in fact, we often don't even have a shared view as the broader evangelical church. That means that we need, at least on some level, to establish what biblical justice is. But before we can do that well, we also need to determine what it isn't. And so tonight is really the first part of what will likely be two or maybe three sermons on the concept of biblical justice, as we need it in order to answer some of the questions we come across in the book of Micah. And so tonight our focus will be on the false theories of justice that are prominent in our culture today. Only after we've considered that can we then focus on the theme of biblical justice itself in a future sermon and then apply that to what we come across in Micah. So with that said, we turn now to Micah chapters 1 and 2. Please do listen carefully. This is God's word for us this evening. The word of Yahweh came to Micah of Moresheth in the days of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, which he saw concerning Samaria and Jerusalem. Hear, you peoples, all of you. Pay attention, O earth, and all that is in it, and let the Lord Yahweh be a witness against you, the Lord from his holy temple. For behold, Yahweh is coming out of his place, and will come down and tread upon the high places of the earth. And the mountains will melt under him, and the valleys will split open like wax before the fire, like waters poured down a steep place. All this is for the transgression of Jacob, and for the sins of the house of Israel. What is the transgression of Jacob? Is it not Samaria? And what is the high place of Judah? Is it not Jerusalem? Therefore I will make Samaria a heap in the open country, a place for planting vineyards, and I will pour down her stones into the valley and uncover her foundations. All her carved images shall be beaten into pieces. All her wages shall be burned with fire, and all her idols I will lay waste. For from the fee of a prostitute she gathered them, and to the fee of a prostitute they shall return. For this I will lament and wail. I will go stripped and naked. I will make lamentation like the jackals and mourning like the ostriches. For her wound is incurable, and it has come to Judah. It has reached to the gate of my people, to Jerusalem. Tell it not in Gath. Weep not at all in Beth-Leaphra. Roll yourselves in the dust. Pass on your way, inhabitants of Shafer. In nakedness and shame, the inhabitants of Zanan do not come out. The lamentation of Beth Azel shall take away from you its standing place. For the inhabitants of Marath wait anxiously for good, because disaster has come down from Yahweh to the gate of Jerusalem. Harness the steeds to the chariots, inhabitants of Lachish. It was the beginning of sin to the daughters of Zion, for in you were found the transgressions of Israel. Therefore you shall give parting gifts to Moresheth Gath. The houses of Aksib shall be deceitful things to the kings of Israel. I will again bring a conqueror to you, inhabitants of Marisha. The glory of Israel shall come to Adullam. Make yourselves bald and cut off your hair for the children of your delight. Make yourself bald as the eagle, for they shall go from you into exile. Woe to those who devise wickedness and work evil on their beds. When the morning dawns, they perform it because it is in the power of their hands. They covet fields and seize them, and houses and take them away. They oppress a man and his house, a man and his inheritance. Therefore, thus says Yahweh, behold, against this family I am devising disaster, from which you cannot remove your necks, and you shall not walk haughtily, for it will be a time of disaster. In that day they shall take up a taunt song against you and moan bitterly and say, we are utterly ruined. He changes the portion of my people. How he removes it from me. To an apostate he allots our fields. Therefore, you will have none to cast the line by lot in the assembly of Yahweh. Do not preach, thus they preach. One should not preach of such things. Disgrace will not overtake us. Should this be said, O house of Jacob? Has Yahweh grown impatient? Are these his deeds? Do not my words do good to him who walks uprightly? But lately my people have risen up as an enemy. You strip the rich robe from those who pass by trustingly with no thought of war. The women of my people you drive out from their delightful houses. From their young children you take away my splendor forever. Arise and go, for this is no place to rest because of uncleanness that destroys with a grievous destruction. If a man should go about and utter wind and lies, saying, I will preach to you of wine and strong drink, he would be the preacher for this people. I will surely assemble all of you, O Jacob. I will gather the remnant of Israel. I will set them together like sheep in a fold, like a flock in its pasture, a noisy multitude of men. He who opens the breach goes up before them. They break through and pass the gate, going out by it. Their king passes on before them, Yahweh at their head. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. We begin this evening by considering the overall shape of this long passage that we've just heard again. In chapter 1, verse 1, Micah begins by introducing himself, something we considered last week. In verses 2 through 5 of chapter 1, Micah then describes how Yahweh is coming against his people in judgment. He's bringing a covenant lawsuit against them and then carrying out a just sentence. In verses 6 and 7, he describes the leveling of Samaria, the capital of the northern kingdom. In verses 10 through 16, Micah then lists the towns of Judah, the southern kingdom, and the lamentations that they will make when God comes to them in judgment as well. And then in between those two descriptions, in verses 8 and 9, Micah himself laments. This is an important reminder to us that Micah is not hardened or stoic in his proclamations, but the words that he has to speak to God's people grieve him deeply. Chapter 2 then shifts a bit as Micah focuses in verses 1 through 5 on the specific sin of the powerful seizing the land of the weak, along with the judgment that will come for this sin. Verses 8 through 10 have a similar focus, decrying how men are stripped of their robes, how women are removed from their homes, and children are removed from their inheritance. Verses 6, 7, and 11 then in chapter 2, which we considered last week, focus on the false prophets who preach wind and whom the people prefer to the truth. And then at the end in verses 12 and 13, we have the shift at the end of the cycle towards hope. Yahweh is described as Israel's shepherd king who will gather the remnant of Israel and lead them. That's the overall shape of the passage before us, the first of three cycles of prophecy that we find in the book of Micah. Tonight, we're going to focus especially in on the accusations of injustice that we find in chapter 2. We see that especially in verses 1 and 2, and also in verses 8 and 9. In chapter 3, which we'll come to next time, Micah will condemn the leaders of Israel for detesting justice. But it's here in chapter 2 that he actually spells out more specifically the sort of things that they're doing. What then are those deeds? Well, let's hear those verses again. Micah writes, "Woe to those who devise wickedness and work evil on their beds. When the morning dawns, they perform it because it is in the power of their hand. They covet fields and seize them, and houses and take them away. They oppress a man and his house, a man and his inheritance." And then jumping down to verse 8, "Lately my people have risen up as an enemy. You strip the rich robe from those who pass by trustingly with no thought of war. The women of my people you drive out from their delightful houses. From their young children you take away my splendor forever." Commentator Dale Davis sums up the deeds that are being written about here, the deeds of the leaders. He writes, "The prophet roasts those who plot their wickedness in advance and then execute it, using force to do so. Their conduct is clearly premeditated. Note the word covet in verse 2. Micah says they even lie awake at night upon their bed scheming how to get richer. Then they pull it off when they go to the real estate office and the court the next day. But what was their wickedness? Verse 2 spells it out. They were amassing land and property. They seized fields. The verb is gazel, to take by force. It's likely that physical violence was involved. One can imagine these people turning up with eviction papers that had the stamp of the local governing authority on them. Their actions were heartless, but technically legal. Verses 8 and 9 indicate that widows and dependent children may have been their special prey. A husband or father may have died, leaving a debt, and so these sharks move in to foreclose on the loan. However, these crooks are magnanimous. They didn't simply pick on women and children, but went after the landowners as well, as we read in verse 2. It seems that Micah especially has in view here actions that were technically legal, but still, Micah says, deeply unjust. These are the acts that Micah decries. Now, as we hear those sorts of descriptions, most people today would agree that what seems to be described here is in fact something that is unjust, that is not how a just society should work. And yet we begin to see the problem we'll consider this evening when we ask, why? Why was it unjust? Then we may start to get different answers. We could even line up four different people who all agree that what Micah describes is wrong, but when asked why it's wrong, they give very different answers. One, for example, will point to freedom and property rights. It'll explain that the landowners owned that land through legitimate means, and so they are free to keep it, and their right to their property should not have been violated. But then another will come along and say nothing about property rights, but instead will speak only of power dynamics in what's described. She'll explain that the entire situation is one more example of how unjust social structures and systems have been put in place by the powerful to oppress the weak. And so the systems themselves must be dismantled, and the oppressed must be given a role in reshaping society into something new. But a third person may then explain it by saying nothing about property rights or power structures. They'll emphasize that what makes the situation so unjust is that it sacrifices the happiness and well-being of the many for the benefit of the few. Justice, they'll explain, should seek to maximize the happiness and well-being of the most people possible. And then a fourth person will give yet another explanation, speaking not primarily of property rights or power structures or maximizing well-being, but of what kind of opportunities a just society should provide. In a world of inequality, she'll explain, a just society will not just protect individual freedom, but will also be willing to redistribute resources to the needy in order to create a society that has equal opportunities for people to achieve their goals. But the situation described in Micah is really the opposite of that. It's the state stripping opportunities from the less powerful instead of promoting and protecting them. Four people, all of whom would agree that what Micah describes is unjust, could easily give four very different reasons as to why it is unjust and also on what the solution should be. As a society today, we do not have a shared view of what justice really is. The debate of what justice is goes back at least to Plato in the Western world. But since the Enlightenment of the 18th century, that debate has fractured in many ways. In that period, people sought to detach the question of justice from religious beliefs and from metaphysical commitments, and sought instead to root it solely in human reason. The result, though, has not been consensus, but division. And that division continues today. We do not, as a society, have a shared theory of societal justice. And opposing views continue to battle in our public and political life. Alistair MacIntyre, who has a book that he's written that's titled Whose Justice, Which Rationality, in another book he notes that in our modern political elections, we are usually not just voting for politicians who will uphold our stance on specific issues, but who will uphold our rival conceptions of justice against other conceptions of justice. But as these divisions over secular justice theories have shaped the world around us, they've also shaped us in the church. Because the fact is that most Christians today in our society, and in fact, I think in many ways, most of us here this evening, most of us don't have a real coherent theology of societal justice. As one Christian commentator pointed out last July, most church-going American Christians have a collection of issues or ethical commands that they think are important, but not really a coherent theology of societal justice. The result is that we tend to borrow a theory of justice from the secular world and then find places for those separate ethical issues that we hold to, the ones that are important to us, find ways to insert them into that theory that we receive from the secular world. But if that's true, then the way we approach societal justice and politics is actually very different from how we approach most other important areas of human life. We might compare that approach to how we in the church think about marriage. It's one thing to be able to list the moral obligations that one has in marriage, to say that husband and wife should provide for one another's needs, that they should not abuse one another, that they should not commit adultery, and so on. That's a list of ethical requirements for Christians in marriage. That is important, but it's a very different thing from having a theology of marriage. It's very different from speaking about the ways that Christian marriage is meant to display the relationship between Christ and the church, or the ways that conduct in marriage is supposed to be an image of the gospel, or the significance for redemptive history that the Bible both begins and ends with a wedding. Now, as Christians, we need both individual ethical commands as well as an overall theology in order to live out our marriages well. But often, when it comes to politics in general and societal justice specifically, most Christians lack a theology of justice and have only a loose collection of ethical issues. The result, as I've said, is that most Christians merely adopt a secular theory of justice, tack on some Christian elements, and then consider it Christian. This tendency becomes most obvious when Christians debate with one another about some aspect of societal justice, whether it's tax policy, racial equality, economic policy, healthcare, or something else. What you most often hear, or at least what I most often hear, is not Christians debating the interpretation of the scriptures relevant to the issues or the historic positions that the church has held on the issue. Instead, what you more often hear are Christians simply defending one of the four secular theories of justice that are most dominant in our society, with a few biblical or historical proof texts added for support. But that is not how you seek to develop a biblical theology of justice. Well, what then are we to do? Well, to begin, we need to be realistic. This is a deep problem, and as interested as I am in the topic, I'm nothing close to an authority on it, and so our goals will be modest. Over the next two or three sermons, I simply hope to help us see some of the problems with how we often approach issues of societal justice, and then to help us see the outline of a different and more biblically rooted way forward. That's really the aim. And so for the rest of tonight, we will very briefly consider the four more dominant secular justice theories in our culture right now, what they teach, what they get right, and where they go wrong. Next time, we'll consider together the roots and some initial aspects of the Bible's concepts of societal justice. Now, for these sermons, I'm drawing heavily on two articles that Tim Keller wrote in August and September of last year. The first is titled A Biblical Critique of Secular Justice and Critical Theory, and the second is simply called Justice in the Bible. Both were published on the Gospel in Life website. As I said, much of what I say tonight will be drawn in different ways from them, and I would commend those articles to you as well. And so with that said, let's turn and let's consider the four secular theories of societal justice that are dominant around us today. The first one we'll consider is known as critical or postmodern theory. And this theory sees justice as primarily being about power. Postmodern critical theory draws on the teachings of Karl Marx, and it's a position that has recently become more prominent and certainly more talked about in our culture. Central to postmodern critical theory is the claim that the explanation of all unequal outcomes in wealth well-being and power is never due to individual actions or to differences in cultures or to differences in human abilities, but only and strictly due to unjust social structures and systems. The only way to fix unequal outcomes for the downtrodden is through social policy, never by asking anyone to change their behavior or culture. With that concept established, postmodern critical theory goes on to argue that all aspects of culture, including religion, are determined by social forces as well, and that the reality at the bottom of everything is really nothing but power. This power across people's lives and across society can be mapped through what's called intersectionality, by which people can be understood to have more or less power depending on their race, their gender, their sexual orientation, their gender identity, or other factors. Within this thinking, those with the least power have the most moral authority, because only they are really able to see things from their position as they truly are. Critical theory then asserts that the role of justice in society is to subvert the power of dominant groups in favor of the oppressed, by putting the oppressed instead into positions of power. Now, as we think about this theory, we should begin by acknowledging some of the things that postmodern critical theory does get right. The Bible repeatedly points to the tendency of those in power to use their power for themselves, and to be willfully blind or indifferent to the ways that they may be hurting the poor and the powerless underneath them. The Bible also gives special concern for the poor and the oppressed. Postmodern critical theory gets these emphases right. But then it also gets a lot wrong. From a biblical standpoint, critical theory is far too simplistic about the most important things in life, because it reduces all of human life to power and wealth. But the Bible tells us that human life and human culture is far more rich and multidimensional than that. For another thing, postmodern critical theory also presents us with a very different picture of human nature, sin, forgiveness, and righteousness than the Bible does. It undermines our common humanity by not only acknowledging the role that race and class and such things may play in life, but by making such categories supersede all other loyalties. It denies the biblical teaching that all humans are sinful from birth, and it sees sinfulness more as being tied to our social groups or our place in a societal system. In addition to that, it offers no real forgiveness for those who do sin, who commit injustice, and no way to unite communities that are divided by sin. We could go on, but in all of these ways and more, the Bible contradicts the postmodern critical theory of justice. But experience does as well. From the evidence of experience, postmodern critical theory does not fit well with real life. It lacks any real avenue for forgiveness and restoration, and that makes it a perspective that doesn't really positively transform people, but rather heightens conflict in a way that does not look like justice to many people. But postmodern critical theory especially falls apart under its own critiques. If the way it critiques other philosophies is applied to itself, it ends up dismantling itself as well. And so if all truth claims, as such this theory proposes, if all truth claims are really just power plays, then wouldn't that apply to the truth claims of postmodern critical theory as well? If social factors completely control how we view reality, then why should we trust the perspectives of advocates of critical theory? And if those in power inevitably use it for domination, then once those who are currently oppressed are put into power, won't they just do the same thing? From the Bible, from experience, and from its own reasoning, a postmodern critical theory of justice cannot really stand. Second, there is the utilitarian theory of justice. This is a theory of justice that is often operating unacknowledged beneath discussions and debates in our culture about public policy. In this view, the essence of justice is the greatest happiness for the greatest number of people. The one qualification is that whatever policies are pursued to achieve this maximum happiness cannot be things that would harm others. What this perspective, again, gets right is the idea that we should not only be concerned with our own well-being, or people who are like us, but we should value the well-being of the larger community, the well-being of our different neighbors. That's a truth that we find in the Bible and that other more individualistic perspectives can tend to miss. That said, this theory of justice also quickly falls apart under scrutiny. Biblically, the utilitarian theory of justice has a flawed and superficial understanding of human happiness, rooting the greatest happiness in material things in this world. When the Bible acknowledges the obvious truth that only eternal realities can support our true and most important happiness and joy. From observing human experience, we also see even more problems, as this theory fails to acknowledge the dignity of the individual, or fails as well to protect the minority from the majority. After all, we can come up with countless examples in history in which what made the majority of society happy was the neglect or the abuse of the minority. And in many cases, those who were misusing the minority argued that their actions were actually what was best for those they were misusing, and so were not really harm. And when we consider this theory according to its own claims, the utilitarian theory of justice has even further problems. The theory claims to be value-free, not telling others how to live. But the introduction of the harm principle, of forbidding policies that will actively harm others, necessarily cuts against that goal. After all, who in the end gets to decide what is truly harmful? What will such a judgment be based on? What will we do when people disagree as to whether or not something is harmful? In the end, we're forced to smuggle in outside value-laden understandings of justice to answer those kinds of questions, which is the very thing that the utilitarian theory seeks to avoid. The next two theories are called the liberal and the libertarian theories of justice, but contrary to what they may sound like, they're not narrow political stances at the extremes of public life, but they're more mainstream philosophical positions that we see around us, even if they're rarely mentioned in those names. Most politically moderate Americans, and I'd say many of us here as well, tend to hold to one or the other of these views as our default way of thinking about justice. The liberal theory of societal justice is rooted in the idea of fairness, and it's centered on two categories of rights. The first set are rights about individual freedom, things like a right to free speech, to property, and to religion. The second set are identified as social or economic rights. They're things like a right to an education or a right to medical care, and so on. John Rawls defends this view by saying that if people devise a society from behind what he calls a veil of ignorance, if they planned the rules for a society having no idea what socioeconomic status or race or gender they themselves would be born into, then he says this is the kind of society that they would design purely out of rational self-interest, one which respects freedom rights, but also one that will redistribute wealth and other resources enough to provide opportunities for those born into less fortunate situations. Unlike the critical and utilitarian theories, the liberal theory is more individual than communal, and its aims more for aims more for equal opportunities and not necessarily for equal outcomes. It acknowledges in those ways the role of individuals in what the final results are. The liberal theory, like all of these, again, gets some things right. It recognizes the importance of the individual, as the Bible does, as well as the special call on society to care for those with greater social and economic needs. In some ways, this overlap is not surprising, as thinkers like Charles Taylor have demonstrated that these values in secular liberalism were largely inherited from the West's past Christianity. But liberalism then tries to take those values and to replant and reform them in secular soil. And as the theory becomes secular, it also begins to have more problems. Biblically speaking, the secular liberal justice theory claims to exclude God in matters of faith from the public square and from discourse about justice, which, to begin with, is something that Christians, of course, are not able to do. It also opens the door for immoral applications. After all, with no supreme moral standards, who gets to decide what should be a social right? What's to prevent the state from asserting that something sinful and harmful is actually something that is now a societal right? And without the moral absolutes of Scripture, on what grounds could you even debate such a claim? But in addition to this biblical problem, liberalism has also shown some of its deficiencies in practice. As more and more scholars have considered lately, the liberal theory's focus on the individual and on the state has led to the atrophy and even to the dissolution of other forms of social life, whether the family, the neighborhood, the church, or a host of other institutions, all of which are weakened under secular liberalism. And their atrophy has not led to greater justice in the world, but it's often led to reduced opportunities for many people. Finally, liberalism as well cannot really support itself. Its whole basis is that justice is defined by the society we would rationally come up with if we didn't know what situation we'd be born into. But one of the first facts is, of course, that we do know. And even if we didn't, who gets to decide what everyone would come up with in such a thought experiment? Who gets to make that decision? Whose values get to go into that decision as it's made? Liberalism turns out to be a less rational position, I wrote a sentence that made no sense there, so I'll go on. Liberalism turns out to be not so much a way in which we rationally come up with a way that society should be organized, but it comes up to be an elaborate way of smuggling in the very kind of faith-based and metaphysical values that liberalism itself denies that it's really based on. And so at the end of the day, it cannot support its ethical values on rationality alone, even as it claims to be purely rational and not religious or value-based. Fourth and finally, there is the libertarian theory of justice, which is another common perspective in our culture and one which many in our circles probably tend towards. If postmodern critical theory sees justice as basically being about power, and utilitarianism sees justice as basically being about happiness, and liberalism sees justice as being basically about fairness, then libertarianism sees justice as being basically about freedom. The libertarian theory of justice therefore does away with the social and the economic rights of liberalism and holds just to the freedom rights. In this view, people have an absolute right to not be harmed, an absolute right to private property if fairly earned, and also the rights of free speech and free association and so on. And as with other views, this theory gets some things right as well. The Bible, of course, supports the view that people should not be unjustly harmed. It also has a strong concept of private property, as implied by the Eighth Commandment, "You shall not steal." But with that said, this view also has some problems. For one thing, there are biblical problems. The Bible does support the idea of a right to private property, but as we look more closely, we recognize that in the Bible, that right is not absolute. The Old Testament, for example, required productive landowners to leave the edges of their fields unharvested so that the poor could come and glean from them. And as it did, it used the language of ownership to explain how that produce, a produce that the landowner had rightfully grown and acquired on his land, how that produce belonged to the poor. It uses the language of ownership so that the produce for the gleaning is not seen as charity, but rather as justice, because God says it rightfully belongs to the poor. Another example is the law of Jubilee, in which every 50 years debts were supposed to be canceled and lands were supposed to be returned to families that had lost them, even if they lost them through their own fault and sold them through legitimate transactions. Now, the point of these examples is that in the Bible's consideration of justice, there is, of course, something like a right to private property, but it's not an absolute right, as libertarian theory demands. In addition, libertarian justice theory has a sub-biblical theory of sin and of freedom. As freedom is seen as merely being negative, and as the dangers of sin are emphasized more in some arenas of life more than in others, such as in the government rather than in the market. in human experience, libertarianism fails to express and to protect the complexities of human life, treating us as isolated individuals when experience tells us that we are richly embedded in community. And on its own terms, libertarian theory fails to support its own claims, particularly about property, which is so essential to the rest of it. As Alistair MacIntyre points out, libertarian theory roots the absolute right to private property in the idea that that property was fairly acquired. But MacIntyre points out that if we look over history, we see the same pattern again and again. The countries and families that exist today did not get their initial wealth through some sort of libertarian experiment. In many cases, or in some countries, in all cases, initial wealth was acquired through invasion, or theft, or slaughter, or other unjust means. What was acquired may after that have been passed on through legitimate transactions, but in a consistent libertarian view, the starting point would also matter. When people point out that one community or race or culture is more prosperous today because of an injustice that their ancestors committed beforehand, many advocates of this view will shrug it off and admit that on some level that's always the case. But that admission doesn't really solve the problem. If the right to private property is really rooted in a fair acquisition, then it would seem that theft at any point would make subsequent ownership illegitimate. And if we argue that it does not, we have to ask ourselves what the time limit is on theft where it becomes just and right for the descendants of the theft to keep the profits of what was stolen, rather than return it to the descendants that it was stolen from. Is that time period a year? A decade? A century? On its own terms, the libertarian theory of ownership begins to break down. So we've considered four common secular theories of justice in our culture. And as we look at them, we see that when evaluated on the basis of the Bible, on the basis of experience, and on the basis of their internal logic, each one, on some level, begins to fall apart. And they fall apart ultimately because they lack a true foundation to support them. They rely on human wisdom, and they quickly become oversimplistic for that reason. Each one, in the end, is oversimplistic about the dignity of humanity, about the realities and the effects of sin, about the hope of redemption, and about the fact that people were made both as distinct individuals and also as people who were made for deep, embedded community. Each secular justice theory is a reminder of the limits of human wisdom, and each secular justice theory leaves us ultimately without a durable framework for societal justice. What then is the way forward? Well, though Micah is not setting out a theology of societal justice here, he does point us to where the root of it is found. And we see it in verses 12 and 13. There, Micah's answer is not a theory of justice, but the person of God himself, dwelling with his people, gathering them in his presence, and leading them as their shepherd. While a biblical theology of justice will, of course, have principles and reasoning, its foundation is not found in a principle or in an argument, but in a person. Biblical justice must be rooted in the character of God himself. As we examine the character of God expressed in his creative work, in his law, in his redemptive work, and in the fact that we are made in his image, it is in God himself that we find an anchor for what societal justice is to look like. We'll consider that in a bit more depth next time so that we can then apply it to Micah's words that we find here. But for tonight, we should leave asking ourselves a few questions. First, what secular theory of societal justice do you most often tend towards? Second, do you see the problems with that theory and that while it may overlap with certain Christian principles, it is not at root itself Christian? Third, do you see how there can be no reliable foundation for justice besides the character of God himself? And then fourth and finally, when faced with questions of justice in the world around us, what are the ways that you need to respond to those questions as they come to you more by pursuing God's heart through the scriptures first And how do you maybe need to resist the temptation to simply jump on one of the secular theories in the world around us? If we want to stand for justice, as Micah calls God's people to do, then we must know what justice is. That starts, of course, by knowing what it's not. But then it proceeds with knowing where to look next. And the answer to that is God himself. And so as we look to God, let us give thanks that in him we have not been left to ourselves, but we truly have all that we need to live as he has called us to live. For he will not forsake his people. Amen.